Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Tom Lynch to discuss some of the key recent data sets in the field. He began by commenting on a landmark study he co-authored that was presented at ASCO and then published soon after in the New England Journal that evaluated the impact of early palliative care in metastatic non-small cell lung cancer.
The palliative care study really is, there's one person who is the engine behind that study for the past, maybe 8 years. This whole line of work is an investigator named Jennifer Temel at Mass General. And I worked with Jennifer for the past decade or so. And when Jennifer came to me as a fellow, she said to me, Tom, she said, I'm really interested in lung cancer, but I'm not interested necessarily in working on EGFR mutations or new drugs as much as I'm interested in trying to figure out how we can best provide the total care to lung cancer patients. And she said, one of the things I think we could do is I think we really should think about how to provide better end-of-life care to them. And this was a burning passion she had years and years ago. And she started with an original pilot, which ended up being published in the JCO, which is a pilot study of approximately 45 to 50 patients, where we assign patients to early palliative care at diagnosis. And one of the concerns was, would patients accept, patients newly diagnosed with lung cancer, would they accept a palliative care assignment at diagnosis?
Now, was it put to the patient as palliative care or just extra supportive care?
It was put to them as palliative care and symptom management, and we use the word palliative care.
Because, you know, it has kind of a hospice, non-anti-tumor type feel, and yet these people in this study that we're going to talk about, they got anti-tumor therapy, correct?
In the pilot study, which preceded the randomized trial, the vast majority of them had anti-tumor therapy as well. And when I talked to patients about it, and I accrued a large number of patients on that study, I said to patients, listen, I said, these doctors are doctors who are very good at symptom management and down the road may be helpful in making decisions and helping to guide care as we go forward. So that was a big part of why I think patients accepted it. And the thing I found was, and Jennifer would be the first to echo this, is that the majority of patients we approached decided to participate. It wasn't a hard sell. So the first study was one of feasibility, showing you could do it, showing you could get them to fill out the quality of life forms, and showing that you could actually do this. So we found very high rates of what looked like improved quality of life. But of course, without a randomized trial, you really couldn't draw any conclusions. So Jennifer then obtained funding from the ASCO Foundation. And since this is not the kind of study that's going to find industry funding very easily, and designed the randomized trial of early versus late intervention. So patients were assigned to either routine palliative care or palliative care early in the course of their disease. And not surprisingly, we were very lucky that a large number of patients participated. There were outstanding palliative care doctors and teams of palliative care caregivers, not just physicians, but social workers and nurse practitioners involved as well. And patients would meet with palliative care once a month. And what I found in my patients who participated in this, the care that I gave really seemed to be no different than any other patient. But what they would talk about with the palliative care doctor was different than what they would talk about with the oncologist. They would talk to the palliative care doctor about their fears of death. They would talk to their palliative care doctor about questions about whether I should maybe stop therapy, where they would never tell that to our oncologist. They didn't want their oncologist to see that they were necessarily thinking about these things.
So you think it was more psychosocial support as opposed to symptom support or both?
I think the shocking thing is I would have thought that pain management would have been better in those assigned to palliative care, and it wasn't. The oncologists do a pretty good job of pain management. Hmm. It was the psychosocial support, and I think qualitatively, patients felt that they had a doctor who they could talk about existential angst with. I mean, Neil, as an oncologist, when you were practicing, how often do patients really tell their oncologist that they have existential angst and that they're worried about dying and they're scared? It's not something, you know, they want to be tough. They want to make sure they get second line and third line and fourth line therapy. So having the palliative care group gave them that out. And we expected to, you know, what we hoped to find in this trial really was that we could make some improvement in quality of life and that we could help with depression and anxiety, which is what we showed. The shock of this study was that the Kaplan-Meier curve showed that there was a survival benefit to the group that received early palliative care. And I think whether or not the sample size was large enough to show a survival benefit, it did statistically, but you know, some people could argue we need a larger study or that that wasn't the primary endpoint. I think what you can conclude is certainly early palliative care didn't inhibit or didn't cause any detriment in overall survival. And I think in this day and age, when you look at the debate over healthcare and the quote-unquote death panels and the idea that palliative care is equated with non-aggressive care, this demonstrated exactly the opposite, that you can do well by integrating palliative care.
Yeah, it was 11.6 months versus 8, p equals 0.02. And yes, it was a small study, but those numbers are better than the FLEX study with cetuximab in non-small cell that was a plenary presentation in ASCO.
Absolutely.
That you commented
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
And it was like, I was thinking, well, if this is a drug, people would be giving it.
If this is a drug, people would be giving it. And if this was a drug, there'd be a multiple million-dollar marketing budget behind it.
So if there really is something here, which I guess you could argue, as you say, it is a small study, what do you think the mechanism is?
Well, I think that one of the mechanisms could be that they're getting better control of depression and anxiety. And if you control depression and anxiety, perhaps they'll make better decisions.
Try harder.
They might try harder.
Maybe
they might
want more aggressive treatment.
Maybe want more aggressive treatment. So maybe by addressing psychosocial needs, you make it more likely they're going to benefit from other therapies. You also could argue that perhaps the quality of the supportive care in a way that's not quite measurable could be better, although that's not entirely obvious from the data that we obtained in the study. Now, what Jennifer, her next step is she wants to look at this in a multi-center study, because one of the concerns, Neil, that I have is, and Jennifer shares, is this was just MGH. What happens when you do this across places that may have different palliative care units? And the second key thing is this something that's applicable to other disease types? And what happens in pancreas cancer? What happens in colorectal cancer? And then the other understanding is we don't have palliative care doctors in every single hospital that are palliative care board certified trained physicians with the depth that they have at MGH. And so that was another part of this, is trying to be able to see what are the elements of the palliative care intervention that are really essential.
You know, there have been speculations forever. I remember when I was in med school about the idea of, you know, does your attitude affect the tumor? There was a famous study by David Spiegel on breast cancer where patients got randomized, I think, to supportive care and they did better. And, you know, it's kind of a popular idea that people have. Do you think there could in some way be some type of humoral systemic effect?
There could be, but I'm not holding out for that. I think what I take from this is that I'm hoping survivals improve, but I'm certain that it's not worsened with early palliative care. And I think you could argue that the quality of life benefits are such that this is an intervention that justifies further investigation and further insight.
Another data set I wanted to ask you about was the so-called ARES observational study.
The ARES study is a real use of bevacizumab study. So what we did in ARES was we collected nearly 2,000 patients who were treated with bevacizumab in the real-world setting. And these were patients who were registered at practices around the country as they were being treated with lung cancer. And I think the real goal in putting this together is to see how did this drug perform in patients in the real world as opposed to just those who are entered into a clinical trial? Specifically because there were a number of, you know, when the ARES study was started, we didn't know it was safe to give it to people on anticoagulation. We didn't know it was safe to give it to people with brain mets. And there was real concern about trying to get a handle on how it performed in those certain subpopulations. And were doctors using it in this manner? In these cohort studies, patients for eligibility really just have to have the disease and the doctor has to feel the regimen is reasonable. And there's no formal entrance criteria that restricts the use otherwise.
I guess it reminds me a little bit of Axel Grothy's BRIGHT study in colon cancer.
Very similar to the BRIGHT registry in colon cancer with very similar goals. And I think that when you collect enough patients, you're able to see that, you know, I think the things that we took home from ARES that look pretty good is that, yes, it can be safely used in people with treated brain metastases, that doctors are pretty good at using it and selecting patients. The thing I was so impressed by is that I think doctors, oncologists, have done a great job at selecting who should get bevacizumab in lung cancer, because the toxicity profile in ARES and the toxicity profile in other studies is actually better than it was in Alan Sandler's original 4599 paper. So docs are picking the right people to treat with this drug. There was a second paper that was presented from ARES, which looked specifically at this cavitation issue versus centrality of tumors.
In terms of pulmonary hemorrhage.
In terms of pulmonary hemorrhage. And you really, you know, the numbers are small, which is fantastic. It's great that the numbers are small. Numbers are small makes it a little bit harder to be dogmatic about what the answers are. But it doesn't appear that location of the primary tumor really appears to drive the rate of pulmonary hemorrhage. And I think that's, again, something which is reassuring to docs as they're considering using bevacizumab.
Although I guess by the time they got selected to be treated, as you pointed out, you know, the docs were pretty judicious about what they did. I guess there were 15 pulmonary hemorrhages out of almost 2,000 patients, so less than 1%.
Right. So it's less common than in the 4599 series. And so with that small number, it becomes very difficult to know what to make of that.
You were also involved in a study looking at potential, I guess, in vivo assessment of the effects of Bev. It kind of was, I guess, an early study beginning to look at this question of how it works. Right now, in your own mind, how do you sort of put together the way Bev works?
I certainly don't have a firm opinion one way or the other. I think the two leading thoughts are that Bev works through the principle of vessel normalization and that that leads to improved delivery of chemotherapy or other agents into the tumor versus directly impairing tumor blood supply. And there's a body of evidence that helps support both hypotheses for the mechanism of action of Bev. I think Bev is an active drug in lung cancer. I think it's not a home run in lung cancer, but it certainly is a good option for doctors when they're thinking about choices for patients. When I have a Bev-eligible patient, I still consider using it. It's not widely used in Europe because the conflicting data between the U.S. and the European investigators have led more of the European docs to feel that the benefit isn't quite large enough to justify the cost. But I think in the United States, we've shown that we can use it safely. And I do believe that the Sandler data is evidence of benefit for the agent. And why it eventually works, I think, will be necessary if we're going to really learn how to get further with it. But I think from Bev, from ASCO, probably the best paper on Bev that influenced me was the ovarian cancer data. So the ovarian cancer data that suggested that maintenance bevacizumab might be important in the bevacizumab study, how that makes me think as a lung cancer doctor, because, Neil, I don't think we're going to have a large trial of that magnitude asking a direct maintenance question, maintenance versus no maintenance. The ECOG will look at maintenance Bev versus maintenance other agents such as pemetrexed, but we won't have the no maintenance question. And the large plenary study from the GOG suggested that the group that received prolonged maintenance did better. And that gives us, I think, a little more evidence to think that the way Alan designed and Dave Johnson designed 4599 with maintenance Bev involved may actually be a reasonable way to give it.
Yeah, I guess in GOG, they gave it during the chemo, and then the other arm got it for a year after, and that was the arm that did better. And the year before, there was the colon study where it was, quote, negative, but yet they had a decrease in relapse rate while they got the Bev.
While they were on it. And again, suggesting that that might have benefit.
Any thoughts about the Canadian BR19 study that looked at, in the adjuvant setting, gefitinib? Can you explain what they looked at and what you think it means?
So the adjuvant gefitinib study was actually one of the more troubling studies from ASCO this year because the adjuvant gefitinib study was designed really to look at gefitinib in the adjuvant setting after resection of lung cancers in Canada. The study was stopped early because of some data that was obtained in the U.S. However, they did follow those patients, and they found that the outcome for the group that received gefitinib was worse than the group that did not receive gefitinib, and it was really concerning because it's very similar to what was seen in the 0023 study by Karen Kelly in stage 3B patients who received chemoradiotherapy and were then randomized to gefitinib or no gefitinib. And this second study to show this same strong trend toward worse outcome, I think makes us pause now in the use of agents in the adjuvant setting without good clinical trial evidence that we're actually helping them. And this comes down to a question, Neil, that you've asked me and others at the Lung Cancer Think Tank many times over the past 5 or 6 years is how do we handle the adjuvant patient with the EGFR mutation? And I think the BR19 study, again, gives us pause that one wants to have solid data that we're actually helping those patients. We have at Mass General and at Yale and other sites, we're doing a trial that Lisa Sequis is leading, looking at specifically EGFR mutated patients. And there will be a large number of patients in a large randomized erlotinib study as well, where a large number of patients will be sequenced that will have some sense of how this performs in the adjuvant setting. But I thought BR19 certainly gives one pause about the use of EGFR TKI in the adjuvant setting. I do not have a great explanation. I talked to Jeff Engelman, I talked to several scientists after the meeting about how could you possibly imagine that in a large group of patients you may be seeing this impaired survival, and I haven't heard any really convincing explanations for it scientifically.
How about just random chance?
Random chance is certainly possible, but there's now two studies that show it. So I'm a little more concerned that it's random chance when the direction of the curves are convincing both in 0023 and in BR19.
Where are we today in terms of understanding, in terms of particularly patients with EGFR mutations, what happens when they become resistant to an EGFR TKI like erlotinib or gefitinib?
I don't think we've, you know, despite a lot of promising leads over the past 3 to 4 years, I don't think I can put my finger and say that we have proven anything really works in this setting. I think there's a lot of interest in looking at the dual kinase inhibitors. There's a HER1 and HER2 inhibitor, which looks very promising, and there's a Boehringer Ingelheim HER1 and HER2 drug that looks very promising as well. Both of these agents may have their role in frontline EGFR TKI. By frontline, I mean first line of EGFR TKI therapy, not in the setting of erlotinib failures. The Arcule compound with erlotinib looks promising as well. But again, I'm not certain that in the setting of relapse that these agents have been proved to be terribly successful.
I mean, do you see responses?
You do see responses, but one of the things we've learned, and we published a paper in Clinical Cancer Research last year with Dave Jackman as the first author, which specifically looked at the question of how we need to evaluate these second-line papers. We know we see responses if you retreat with erlotinib. So we got a little ahead of ourselves because we started getting very excited about seeing responses in the second line after erlotinib failures and assuming that that was due to the new intervention. And then when we got some more experience and realized that you'd see these retreatment responses, it's caused some pause. And if you look at the rate of response, they're very low in whether you add chloroquine or whether it's the Pfizer drug or the Boehringer Ingelheim drug. They're less than 10%. And the retreatment response appears to be the same. So that's got to be sorted out. And I'm not sure when I see a patient who is truly refractory in second line, I look for a clinical trial that may specifically address that. Short of a clinical trial option, I usually keep them on the TKI at that point and look for adding other drugs into that.
Now, these agents, I've heard the term irreversible TKI. Is that the case?
So the Boehringer and the Pfizer drug are both irreversible TKIs, tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And there's some theory that if you have an irreversible inhibitor and you also have the activity against HER2, what relative contribution that may be playing, I think, is unclear. But certainly it's a reason to think that there might be a relative advantage there.
What about clinical data right now with these agents and upcoming clinical data?
So we're going to get some upcoming clinical data hopefully by the end of this year on the Boehringer agent. There's a large trial comparing it to best supportive care in third line and beyond lung cancer. So that will be one group that will get some evidence as to how that performs in that setting. We had some data at ASCO this year on the Pfizer compound that looked very promising, particularly in groups of patients that we didn't necessarily expect to see benefit in, and in those patients with non-small cell lung cancer who were non-mutants, non-EGFR mutants. So I think that both of those drugs have potential for use. I'm just not certain, to answer your first question, I'm not certain it's going to be in the setting of refractory disease. I think it might be that they may become preferred first-line agents for tyrosine kinase use.
Do you want to comment on the EML4 ALK story? Obviously, that was a meeting plenary presentation, very prominent. It had been presented. Data started to be presented the year prior to that. Can you kind of go back through what they looked at and where we are right now with this concept?
So I think this is probably the most important story in lung cancer this year, and certainly probably over the past 5 years, is identification of a second type of lung cancer that is an example of oncogene addiction, where a targeted therapy looks like it's going to make a significant impact in this disease. So the story behind this was that in Japan in 2007, the EML4 ALK translocation was discovered and was found to be a driver mutation in lung cancer cell lines. At the same time, Pfizer was developing a kinase inhibitor, which appeared to have a benefit in, was targeting MET as its primary target. But it's a fairly dirty kinase inhibitor and hit a number of different kinases, including the anaplastic lymphoma kinase or ALK kinase. And so this was in phase one trials at a number of centers, including the Mass General where I was practicing. And at that point, the trial was open as a phase one, and you could enroll patients really with any stage of disease. But when we learned about the translocation identified in Japan, we started screening patients for this ALK translocation. We thought this would be a reasonable approach to try. And one of the big defining parts of the development of this story, I think, really is the molecular diagnostics. I give a lot of credit to a guy named John Iafredi, who's at the MGH, who's a pathologist, who came up with a very nice FISH assay. It was a complicated FISH assay, but he was able to reliably identify the ALK translocated patients. And what we found in a paper published by Alice Shaw last year was that it appears that about 5% overall of lung cancer is ALK translocated. It appears to be a non-smoking phenomena, appears to be a little more common in men than in women, unlike the EGFR mutations, and the patients appear a little bit younger than the patients who have EGFR mutations. But once we started treating people with the Pfizer compound, remarkable responses were seen, very similar to the very early EGFR mutation responses. And this year at ASCO, we saw an update of the paper, Eunice Kwok being the lead investigator from MGH, and the lead investigator from the paper at ASCO was from Korea. And we saw really where that stands, and a remarkable, when I saw the waterfall plot, it was one of the most incredible waterfall plots I've ever seen in lung cancer, with response rates in excess of 60 to 65%, and looking like progression-free survival is going to be quite good as well. Will this cure patients? No, I don't think it will cure the majority of patients. There may be some. I think the story will be very similar to the story in EGFR mutations, in that after 18 months to 24 months, I think we will begin to see emergence of resistance. But it is an amazing story in that for these patients, we're getting remarkable benefits. And I think from the perspective of the practicing oncologist, screening patients for ALK is something that should be done. It's now commercially available by a number of laboratories, and sending your samples out for ALK fish, I think, makes great sense. And ALK fish may not be the answer in 4 or 5 years. I suspect we'll have an immunohistochemistry test, which will be easier than doing fish. But for now, sending out for the ALK fish, I think, makes great sense in any never smoker or light smoker that you see. Same thing with the EGFR mutation.
What about smokers?
I think in smokers, the incidence has been very, very small. I think one can make a very valid argument to test every lung cancer patient. It's reasonable, but I think the yield is going to be much less than in never smokers. And my impression is there have been very few smokers found with ALK. There have been some smokers found with EGFR mutations for sure, and we just don't know enough yet about this. I think one of the real questions, this was brought up by the discussant at ASCO, is what the FDA response will be to this incredible phase 2 trial. So you have a phase 2 trial that is just remarkable for benefit. And you know, the FDA has been telling us, bring us targeted drugs in targeted populations. You know, they've been saying they don't want to see targeted drugs in general populations. Well, here's a phase 2 brought to them, a targeted drug in a targeted population. In fact, it's a phase 1-2. Is that enough to approve the drug? Is it really ethical to do the phase 3 that's open now? The phase 3 that's open now is in second-line therapy, randomizing patients to the ALK inhibitor versus chemotherapy in second line. Now, I agree, whether you get your ALK inhibitor second line or third line, you'll probably do okay. But there inevitably will be some patients who will get chemotherapy and will fall off the bus and won't ever get to the ALK inhibitor. And I just wonder what the FDA's response will be to the ASCO presentation. I think you could make a strong argument to approve the drug based on the data we have right now.
And I guess in that study, they are able to get it on crossover.
They are able to get it on crossover.
But as you said, maybe they won't make it to that point.
I mean, we know that in clinical practice, a third of the patients fall off at each line of therapy.
Yeah, you know, because I remember a comparable time in terms of the EGFR TKIs where you were seeing these obvious responses. And I was like, hey, you know, if I had non-small cell and I wasn't a smoker, because that was even before we even knew about EGFR TKIs that much, you know, I was thinking, I don't know if I'd be wanting to take chemo. And yet it wasn't really till the IPES randomized study that everybody all of a sudden changed what they did. Are we going to have to go through that whole thing again with this thing?
I don't think so. I think that from talking to physicians in the community, I think docs are going to want to use this drug. I think they learned from the EGFR story, and I think that they're going to be screening patients. They're going to want this drug for patients.
So speaking of new and exciting drugs that maybe you want to get to your patients pretty soon, of course, in our CME programs, we've been talking a lot about Dr. Stephen O'Day's plenary presentation of ipilimumab, the T-cell stimulator in melanoma, but you also had a presentation at ASCO looking at it in lung cancer. What did you look at there?
So we had a paper which was not a randomized phase 3 trial. It was just a randomized phase 2 trial looking at chemotherapy one arm, chemotherapy plus ipilimumab starting at cycle 3 versus chemotherapy with ipilimumab starting at cycle 1. And what we found in our study was that the delayed group that received ipilimumab at cycle 3 really did better than the chemotherapy alone arm. And both ipilimumab arms appeared to have progression-free survival benefits. Now, granted, it was a randomized phase 2. It was not powered for overall survival, but it was an intriguing study. The magnitude of benefit was modest, but certainly is intriguing to suggest that we may need a phase 3 study. One of the things I've been struggling with since that study from listening to Steve's presentation is that ipi in melanoma is associated with more side effects than we saw in the lung cancer.
I was going to ask you about that because they had some scary things happen.
They did. They had colitis and they had hepatitis. And
Pituitary
things. And I kept waiting for that in the lung cancer trial and we didn't see it.
Maybe they weren't on it long enough?
Well, no. I think what's hitting me now, what I'm thinking about now is, and it happened because I was attending on the floor 3 months ago, and Mario Schnall at Yale is our melanoma doc, and he had a patient he wanted to get in the ipi trial that I was the attending for, and he said, Tom, I'm not going to treat him with ipi because he's on Decadron for brain mets. And I said, Mario, I said, but why? He goes, because the steroids will blunt the ability of ipi to work. And I said, but the way we designed the lung trial, they're getting paclitaxel, and they're getting, you know,
interesting,
40 a Decadron.
Right, you know? And actually the treatment of a lot of these anti-immune things is steroids.
It's steroids. And so I said, we're giving this slug a Decadron. And he turned to me and said, that's idiotic, okay? And so I wonder if ipi in a setting without Decadron, okay, would give you slightly more side effects, which I think it would, but perhaps more activity. And so maybe the activity of ipi is even better than we think if we could get rid of the steroids. And the good news is we have lots of options now. We can use we can't use pemetrexed without steroids, but you could use nab-paclitaxel without steroids. And so drugs like nab-paclitaxel, drugs like gemcitabine may be reasonable now to look at with ipi in this setting without having to use steroids.
Well, that's fascinating. What did you think about the nab-paclitaxel data that Mark Soczynski presented at ASCO?
I mean, I think we've seen this pattern with nab-paclitaxel in a number of diseases. It appears to be slightly more effective in terms of response rate than the traditional paclitaxel in that setting. I think people will use nab-paclitaxel. I think one of the issues in lung cancer is how would that compare to pemetrexed in the non-squamous patients? So in adeno patients, would you give up pemetrexed and use nab-paclitaxel in that setting? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think most docs will give up pemetrexed for the adeno patients because they tolerate it so well.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess the other issue would be ipi without chemo in more advanced disease. Has that been looked at in lung?
It has not been looked at in lung. I think it certainly is justified to look at in lung based on what we found so far. And the other question that I was asked a number of times is why the difference between whether you give the ipi cycle 3 or cycle 1? And, you know, there's some people who feel that antigen presentation is better after a couple of cycles of chemotherapy and so therefore more likely to stimulate the immune system. I really don't have a good explanation for that.
Yeah, that whole thing. And also even the mechanism was really amazing to me. This is really immune therapy. I mean, I guess they really stimulate T cells, you know.
They do, and this will be the first of several antibodies which affect these co-stimulatory molecules that look like they're going to have activity in solid tumors. So we are entering a really exciting time for immune therapy in solid tumors. And I'm coming from the perspective of a guy who never believed immune therapy was going to
pan. I was always so sketchy.
I always thought it was sketch.
Totally.
And I really do believe that ipi will be the first of three or four of these drugs which should have a major role.
Really fascinating. Let's talk about your cases. I got to ask you about your 68-year-old African-American man. What a case.
So this is a case I was actually called about by a physician from the Midwest who called me up and said, Tom, I've got this patient I got to talk to you about. And he said, you won't believe it. And I said, okay, go ahead. And I thought I'd heard them all at this point. He said, this 68-year-old African-American patient came in with fatigue and some shortness of breath. And we worked him up, and he had a white count of 68,000, a crit of about 21, platelet count of 550,000. This doctor's a hematologist, oncologist, did a bone marrow, and he said it showed CML. He said, so we went ahead and BCR-ABL was positive. We put him on imatinib, and I saw him a month later. He was fatigued but had a normalization of his white count, normalization of his platelet count, and his hematocrit was still depressed at 23%. He said, so I was concerned about it, but I said, well, let's just see a month later how things work. A month later, he had a beautiful response in his marrow, but the hematocrit still was depressed, and the shortness of breath was more of a feature. So they went ahead and worked up with a CAT scan of the chest. And, you know, I don't think I've ever heard of a CAT scan of the chest being used to stage CML, but the CAT scan of the chest showed multiple lung nodules, and biopsy showed lung cancer with an EGFR exon 19 mutation. So here you had a patient who has both CML responding beautifully to a targeted kinase inhibitor and now has lung cancer.
He's a non-smoker?
Never smoker with an exon 19 mutation. And what do you do next? And this is something we talked about at all of our conferences at Yale and really brought the hematologists and the solid tumor docs together. And there were two real thoughts as to what could be done. There have been some studies using the kinase inhibitors together, but the toxicity of tool kinase inhibitors is not trivial. And the fatigue and tiredness, particularly of putting these drugs together, is one that does have us a bit concerned. I would argue of these two diseases that the non-small cell lung cancer is probably more life-limiting than the CML, particularly because he's had such a beautiful response to CML.
Incidentally, why do you think he had the hematocrit of 23?
I think he was anemic from his lung cancer.
This is a systemic effect?
Would be my gut feeling. We do see anemia in lung cancer. Patients who have widespread lung cancer can present with anemia.
Chris has got CML in his marrow. So maybe.
And he also, you know, his marrow was never perfect to start with, so it's certainly possible. I think one of the key questions will be what happens to his hematocrit when his lung cancer is treated. We'll have to see how that happens. But there really were two feelings here. One was you could use both drugs. And the issue with the erlotinib is one could use erlotinib at lower doses in mutants and probably still get a very nice response. I don't think you have to give 150 milligrams of erlotinib. So you could come up with an idea, keep him on his imatinib and dial in some low-dose erlotinib, see if he tolerates it and watches lung cancer. You should get a response. Others, and my hematology colleagues said, listen, you know, you can stop his imatinib for a month or two. He's already had a great response. Give him erlotinib, see if he responds to his lung cancer, and then dial back in the imatinib afterwards. And I think the doctor in the Midwest is probably going to proceed with the latter approach of holding the imatinib, giving him some full-dose erlotinib, see if he responds. Because if he doesn't have a great response, and we think about 70% will have great response, but 30% won't. If he doesn't have a great response, it probably is going to be a moot point. But I think this idea of coming up with a regimen with both kinase inhibitors to keep both diseases at bay will be very intriguing and interesting as we go forward.
I guess you could give him lung chemo too.
You could, and that's what we learned from IPASS, is you could give him lung chemo and see a very nice response in this setting. And that's a very good point. You could give him regular chemotherapy. And there are plenty of examples of imatinib. You know, we tried hard to find a role for imatinib in lung cancer for years. Didn't really pan out, mostly in small cell. But we know we have good safety data that it can be given safely with chemotherapy. So that could have been an option as well.
So in terms of potential biologic issues, I guess this is just a coincidence?
I think it's a coincidence. I think it's two extraordinarily rare mutations occurring in a gentleman. But, you know, obviously, does he have some issue with DNA damage repair or something else that could predispose him to developing these mutations? I don't know. But it's, I think, an extraordinary coincidence.
So before you go on to your next case, when you said DNA repair, I meant to ask you before, anything happening in terms of PARP inhibitors in lung cancer?
So I had actually another patient that I was thinking of presenting, a woman who is 55 years old, who presented approximately 5 years ago with breast cancer. I had about a 2-centimeter breast cancer, went on to have a lumpectomy, radiation therapy, an adjuvant AC followed by T, was found to be a BRCA carrier, and at that point went on to have bilateral mastectomies. And that was done relatively early in the course of her treatment. So she had bilateral mastectomies, doing well from her breast cancer, and then presents with a lung mass about 5-6 years later.
Again, non-smoker?
She was a smoker. Presents with a pretty much looks like a garden variety adenocarcinoma of the lung, metastatic disease, treated with chemotherapy, and now comes in for second-line therapy. So treated with traditional chemotherapy on the outside, and I saw her as a consultation. And I'm trying hard to try to find a PARP inhibitor trial for her because one would imagine that her lung cancer cells should be BRCA1. Not should be, they are BRCA1 mutant. And, you know, would she respond to a PARP inhibitor with chemotherapy? And obviously it's a rare case, but I think it does show that that may be one place where you'd see some benefit. But even in the non-BRCA mutants, I think that there is some interest in looking at the PARP inhibitors in lung cancer. There's some large randomized trials which are being designed that people are eager and excited about getting to.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, this issue of any tumor that's going to develop in somebody who's BRCA positive – theoretically, I guess, has it been seen?
I don't know. That's the question, is I don't know. I've heard anecdotes, but I haven't seen anything hard and fast that can tell me there's been responses.
I guess the other thing we've heard about PARP inhibitors that I haven't seen too much on yet is the issue of combining it with radiation therapy, of course, not specifically to lung cancer. Anything, mm-hmm. any trials going on there that you've been involved with?
Not that I'm aware of. I know in lung cancer, there's one large randomized trial with a PARP inhibitor, which is actually open soon.
I know that you're a real advocate for basic research, translational research, new agents, but are there any cooperative group trials or questions out there that are being addressed that you think are important to keep an eye on?
So I keep an eye on the ECOG study looking at maintenance. I think the maintenance question in lung cancer is unknown.
Can you go through the design of that?
So it's a randomized trial looking at people who've received upfront chemotherapy, asking a question of maintenance with bevacizumab, pemetrexed, or both in the maintenance setting. And I think that there are a lot of unanswered questions in how to approach maintenance. It's also a big question for us as we look at new drugs. So we're looking at new targeted drugs with chemotherapy. And we're struggling with the question of, well, how do we handle maintenance in this setting? You want a progression-free survival, but will the doc in the community feel comfortable with holding maintenance if we don't design it into the trial? And I think that ECOG study will go a long way toward helping to answer that question of what potential role optimal maintenance will be. The other study I would keep my eyes open for looks at people who have had carbo-PEM, asking the question of maintenance PEM in the setting of people with carbo-PEM. You know, we know that the study that was presented by Dr. Bolani or published by Dr. Bolani that looked very good looking at maintenance, the JMEN study looking at maintenance pemetrexed, none of those patients had carbo-PEM as their induction. And I think we all are wondering, really, can you use maintenance PEM? And does the data look as promising as it did in that study?
Because the other way, if they haven't had it up front, you're kind of giving them second-line therapy.
You give them early second-line therapy. And so that becomes something which, when you go to the lung cancer meetings, people can get all lathered up about.
And I guess a related question that this ECOG study sort of is getting into is the patient who gets carbo-PEM-BEV up front, then what do you do about maintenance?
Exactly. And so the patient gets carbo-paclitaxel-BEV up front, and you want to give them maintenance. Do you give them PEM-BEV maintenance? I think that might be a great idea. If you ask me what's my bias, that's pretty good bias. I think that there's legs to that, but particularly from the ovarian data that we talked about earlier. So I think those will be really important questions that the cooperative groups can ask. I think the other thing that, you know, we've seen a lot of commentary on in my new roles in the cancer center at Yale as a cancer center director, thinking about how we do cooperative group research and how we fund cooperative group research, there's really a whole movement now to re-looking at cooperative group studies. You know, do we have the right structure of cooperative groups in the United States? Would we do better with one larger cooperative group rather than five smaller ones with focused disease committees that can give a menu of studies to institutions around the country? And I think Dr. Mendelsohn from MD Anderson chaired a committee for the Institute of Medicine that really came up with some very thoughtful recommendations about how we can reform the cooperative group system to make things easier, make things more streamlined, and get these kind of studies out to patients quicker than we're doing right now. You know, the typical cooperative group study can take 3 years from inception to first patient in, and that's just not acceptable if we're going to start to ask meaningful questions.
Getting back to the issue of maintenance, what tends to be your usual chemo-BEV upfront regimen right now?
I'm still using carbo-paclitaxel-BEV upfront, and I know a lot of practitioners are too when you look at usage data. Many use it because they're afraid of not getting reimbursed for bevacizumab and pemetrexed. I use it because I like the idea of coming in with maintenance PEM. And so off of protocol, I think carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and then bevacizumab with pemetrexed is perfectly reasonable as an option. I think you'd also be fine just to do maintenance bevacizumab in that setting and then reserve your pemetrexed for true second-line therapy. And that would be more evidence-based at this point.